This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 327 of the show where we talk aviation. If you want to follow along with us, you can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com/327. Well, I'm Max Flight, and with me is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening from Chicago, where we have recently heard news that the new George Lucas Museum that's coming to Chicago may be built over the top of Soldier Field, which is the home of the Chicago Bears, and they think they might do that because the Bears don't seem to need it anymore.
All right. Thanks for that important news, Rob. We really appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. Also with us is Brian Coleman. Hi, Brian.
Good evening, Max. And my making fun of the Raiders last week apparently only worked for 1 week because, boy, did they get a smackdown on Sunday. So... oh, well, I'm going to have to figure out some other way to get them going.
One can hope. All right. Well, our guest this episode is Victoria Zyko. Victoria works in the aviation insurance business, supporting general corporate and business aviation needs. She's also co-host on the Stuck Mike Avcast and is co-author of the Turbo the Flying Dog series. So, Victoria, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Now, as we were talking before the show started, you were last on this podcast back in January in episode 281. And I guess you've been, doing some writing since then?
Yeah, I'm on to a fun and new project. It's inspired by my dog. And it's been great. And the support from the aviation community has been amazing. And partially because it's about a flying dog. And partially because you guys just rock and are supportive, and that's kind of why I'm here today.
Fantastic. Okay, we're going to talk about the book, and we can't avoid talking about the Stuck Mike Avcast. It'll be fun. We can talk about the other guys while they're not here listening.
Mwahaha.
Okay, but we're going to start off with some of the current aviation news. There's a lot of drone news in the airwaves these days, and so we'll touch on some of that. And we're also going to talk about how charitable organizations and pilots provide transportation for those in need, sometimes human, sometimes otherwise. And then in the Australia desk this week, we're going to hear from my favorite Australian. That's Anthony, the infrequent flyer, Simmons. He's going to talk about the Australian National Aviation Museum's Commonwealth Aircraft Corporation, Wirraway. And then in the Across the Pond segment, Peter catches up with Neil Braden. Now, you may remember him as the student pilot who was on the show way back in 2011. And now he's a GA pilot flying in both Europe and the U.S. And Neil's going to explain the differences in the GA sector and also offer some advice based upon his experiences. And we should mention that David Vanderhoof, our Airplane Geeks historian, is off this week. And we look forward to his return, hopefully next week. And then we'll finish up with a little bit of listener feedback. So with that, if you guys are ready, we'll start off with the aviation news. Are you ready?
Okie dokie.
Let's go.
Woo!
All right, drones. Well, whether you call them drones or UAVs or UAS, unmanned aerial systems, as the FAA likes to call them. There's a lot of action in the news this week, and maybe what I'll do, Rob, is set this up a little bit and then let you jump in, since you've made some appearances in the network news recently with some interesting topics on this subject. I guess what we should start off by saying is that, as most people know, the United States, we've been waiting for the regulations to come out of the FAA concerning, at least initially, small UAVs or small UAS, as the FAA calls them. And they tell us that sometime by the end of this year, we'll see an NPRM, a Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, from the FAA. This will be in advance of a public comment period, and all this leading up to eventually some regulations. And there have been some news stories out about what might be in those in that NPRM. And in fact, the FAA Administrator Michael Huerta has made some comments about what might be in there, but they're not being really specific yet. But Rob, you know, there have been a couple of things mentioned that really have caused some people concern.
Well, I think the thing that's causing people concern is just what you touched on, the fact that it has been so long since the FAA has been, since they initiated this process, and they haven't given anybody any details. And so what happens is that when you don't give anybody anything specific, people make it up. It's long to fill in the gaps. And of course, here in the United States, as in a lot of other countries, you know, the small UASs, UAVs, RPVs, whatever they are called, is a hot topic. And as I have said, you know, in fact, we did, when we did our Aviation Minute episode 4 last, we were talking about that. And I really support the drone concept. I love what they can do. I only care about one thing. Just make sure you can prove to me how you're going to keep the darn things from coming through the windshield of an airplane I'm flying at 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 feet, whatever. And that has not happened yet. That technology doesn't even exist commercially yet. But everybody is saying, oh, don't worry about it. That'll all work out. And don't worry, the people will know what to do. Well, there have been a number of incidents with people, unfortunately, giving the whole industry a black eye by flying these darn things close to commercial airports. Last week, there were 3 incidents in just a couple of days at JFK in New York. And the FAA administrator, as you mentioned, was on CNN this last weekend. And lo and behold, he just said, the rules are coming, and didn't really respond to anything. But I managed to get a quick gig on CNBC last week with a lady from Duke University who is a huge supporter of drones, as am I. And we got into a discussion in which she mentioned that, because I said, you know, we just need to figure out a way to keep them away from powered airplanes and with passengers on them. And she said, oh, no. We should be mixing everybody together, keeping them all in the same airspace. And I thought the lady had lost her mind, especially when she said, if you've ever flown on an Airbus, you know, you've flown on a drone, because that's all that an Airbus is a big drone. And I was, of course, had my earpiece in, and in my mind, I was saying, yeah, except the Airbus has pilots. But I didn't say that. But apparently, from what it looked like on camera, my eyes kind of looked like, are you kidding me? But I know you guys listened to it as well. But I don't know, Max, what did you think of that short segment? I mean, besides my incredible performance, of course.
Well, yeah, the eye rolling was pretty significant on her last comment. I think up to that point, I think it was a great conversation, and I thought that the points were, you know, for the most part, valid. I liked your, you know, you need to prove to me that this will work kind of approach. And it's, you know, it didn't strike me as being the thoughts of a cynic, but the thoughts of a realist. And I think you have a good point that, you know, there's a lot of aspects to making sure that this is all done safely that are yet to be proven. You know, and a lot of people will say, well, you know, it's not a big deal. But, you know, yeah, when there's one or two quadcopters around that can be controlled, that's one thing. But if you're talking about thousands or tens of thousands of these things delivering packages, providing aerial journalism to news agencies, to the military, to firefighters, to, you know, all to farmers, to all of these groups that have great applications in mind for them, it becomes a real problem. I know, Victoria, you're a pilot. What do you think about this? Do you look at or think about this prospect in terror in your eyes, or are you pretty comfortable with what's happening?
I think I'm mostly curious, and especially since I'm in aviation insurance and we're getting into UAV insurance, there's just so much I feel like we don't know. And I feel like insurance-wise, we're just kind of guessing right now. And a lot of the companies are like, you know, we don't know what the Cessna 150 of drones are, and we don't know what the Citation of drones are. And sometimes I'm wondering, do we have a definition of what qualifies as a UAV that would potentially cause harm to an airplane in the air? Like, I used to think of my grandpa flying RC airplanes or the little remote helicopter I got my husband. Those would just bounce right off a plane and just be shattered. But then I also think of, like, you know, the Air Force has their Predators, and that's something major. So when I hear about Amazon thinking about delivering packages, are they doing it on the little mini helicopter, or are they doing it on a Predator? And I haven't seen anything. Yeah.
There's something that's kind of in between. It may be closer to the smaller quadcopter kinds of things that you've seen, but not exactly lightweight. When you look at what those who are using these for filming, either movies or for television commercials, for example, things like that, these have pretty substantial cameras on it, a lot bigger than little tiny GoPros. And they're often octocopters, oftentimes with 10 or 12 inch rotors, and they're not lightweight. If one of those were to strike an aircraft in flight, or if one of those was to have an equipment failure and fall into the crowd below, let's say, there's likely to be some significant damage. So, yeah, they're not the type that's just going to bounce off, like you say, Victoria. That you know, the little kind of, I'll say, toy RC remote control copters are of that sort. That's an issue.
Well, but you know, I think what would help the debate, at least, and I certainly felt that the other day on this TV show, is that if I could have at least gotten the lady to admit, okay, you're right, that is a piece of the pie, this ability to prove that a sense and avoid system for a drone above, I don't know, as Victoria said, I don't think we figured that out yet, above what weight? Above 5 pounds, about 10 pounds? I mean, what's a Canada Goose weigh? 12, 14 pounds? And I mean, they've practically destroyed an airplane when one of those things has come through the windshield. So it doesn't have to be too heavy before it is potentially dangerous. But again, if we could have just gotten someone to say, yes, we need that piece of the pie in order to sell these things, which is, how do we keep them away from airplanes? But the fact that the woman said, we don't even care about that. It's just about, you know, making sure that they're commercially viable and that the government doesn't get in the way of you know, selling these things and using them commercially. And of course, the FAA is feeling the pressure. There's no doubt that they're slow. We all know that they've been taking forever, but pressuring them to get something in place when they don't have the safety part worked out, whether it's keeping them away from airplanes or keeping them away from each other. What if they have a mid-air collision over a crowd? Nobody's talking about that. That's got to be in place somewhere, at least to me.
And when you talk about the pressure, we've seen some indications that the U.S. Senate, the lawmakers there, they really would like to encourage the FAA to speed up the integration of these things, UAVs, into the national airspace. The FAA kind of takes its Well, it's marching orders from Congress in many cases. And I don't know, maybe we'll see something come out of Congress that will affect the speed at which this is done. We know already that the FAA is behind what Congress had originally wanted. What do you think is Congress's concern? Why do you think they might want to speed up the integration into the national airspace?
I think it's because they want to see them become commercially viable machines to organizations that want to use them and make it easier for them to use, which, again, I fully support. I just want to make sure that we all know where they are. And right now we have no way of knowing that. But again, I just think it's the commercial side that they're really pushing for.
Yeah, I would agree. All right. Well, of course, David and I talk about this at greater length over at the UAV Digest podcast. So if you're interested in following this in more detail, you can listen to that. So maybe we ought to push on. As I mentioned at the beginning, we have a few stories about humanitarian services that are provided by aviation organizations. And those of you listening might want to consider making donations to these causes. Just want to point out first before we get started that we here at Airplane Geeks, we don't specifically endorse any of them, but we will have links to many of them in the show notes, and we encourage you to take a look and evaluate them and make your own decisions if you'd like to support one or more of these. So the first one we have, this comes from AvWeb, a story in AvWeb, Endangered Sea Turtles Need GA Transport. This is kind of interesting. We have something that we would call migratory turtles. And apparently, like many New Englanders, they spend their summers in the waters off of New England, and then they swim south in the winter. But this year, because of some sort of differences, some changes in the wind and water temperatures, a lot of these turtles have been stranded, more than 400 of them, along some of the beaches in Cape Cod or on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And according to Leslie Weinstein, a board member for the Archie Carr Center for Sea Turtle Research, that's at the University of Florida, they need transportation to aquariums. They're stranded. So there's an aviation rescue effort underway. They're working with the National Guard, but also with volunteer groups like Pilots and PAWS to solicit some help from the general aviation pilots. You know, I have to say that in a lot of these organizations, the GA pilots really do kind of step up and help out in some of these causes.
Yeah, Max, when I was living up in the Bay Area, I used to volunteer at a group called the Marine Mammal Center. And our charter was to rehabilitate seals and sea lions. And every once in a while, one of them needed to be moved. And it was always fun when a pilot stepped in to move a sea lion or elephant seal. And some of them could get quite large. And having a 800-pound, 1,200-pound animal roll around in the back of a plane, I think requires some special talent from the part of the pilot. But it's definitely rewarding along the way.
Oh, for sure. And a lot of times there's no alternative, no real other way to provide this kind of transportation.
Wait, you're rehabilitating them, you said?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what do? You kind of give them job training, and what do you do? Turn them into hey, you're going to be a bartender now.
Oddly enough, we would teach them how to fish. Yeah, how to eat.
Yeah, there you go.
Aww. Yep.
Now that they could learn from my dog, trust me.
No, if the pups are separated from their moms, they never learn how to eat, so we teach them how to fish.
You know, go ahead.
I was going to say, you struck a good point about the pilot having to be careful with such a large animal flying around, especially, I mean, that could be quite a distraction and especially ruin your center of gravity, I guess. There was a YouTube video going on a while back of a baby elephant that was rescued. And they were just in maybe a Cessna Caravan, but I think it was smaller. And there's this baby elephant playing with his water bottle and kept tapping the pilot on his shoulder occasionally. And it was an adorable moving video, but you have to think, wow, you got to be really careful when you're doing that.
Yeah, but did you hear the audio on that with the elephant going, "What's that down there?"
Are we there yet?
Yeah, exactly.
Did they serve peanuts in flight?
But you know, the other point that you made, I forgot who said it before, but you know, the pilots of small airplanes, GA airplanes, really do step up. Let's look at the Angel Flight side too, and the thousands of hours of free transportation that people offer medical patients in small airplanes to carry them from one place to another. And so there are lots of things that go on like that.
Victoria, are there insurance issues associated with this for pilots?
Not that I can immediately think of. A lot of the larger organizations will request to be added as an additional insured on your policy. There's usually no cost for that. That just covers them in case they're sued because, you say you were flying and someone was injured who's flying on behalf of, you know, like Angel Lift or something like that. But no, usually there's no issues.
We have another story. This is actually from last year, but it's a great story. This is about there was a Marine who was serving in Afghanistan, and he had two rescue dogs. These are Anatolian Shepherds, which I'd never heard of. My wife, who knows just about everything about every breed, said, "Oh, of course, she knew all about them." This was Dusty and Wyatt. And he actually was able to get the dogs back to the U.S. When his tour of duty ended. He had some assistance from an animal rescue organization. But later he was transferred across the country, and the airlines weren't able to provide transportation, I guess because these dogs were so large. And so the heiress to the Wrigley Gum Enterprise stepped in and chartered a private jet to bring the dogs to the new location. She's the founder of this animal rescue organization called On the Wings of Angels Rescue. It's a another nice example of someone recognizing a situation. In this case, these poor dogs, and stepping in and providing something that really has a lot of value, but would cost a ton of money if you had to go out and spend your own money to do that. Another great example.
No, they're still flying. Wings of Rescue. I mean, they're still continuing moving animals around. So I think that it's great what they're doing.
Fantastic, yeah. Well, keeping with the animals on flights, and a little different example is, there was an article recently about a woman. This is actually in Hartford, close to me, who brought a pig on board a plane and claimed that this was an emotional support pig. And the airline didn't think much of that and threw the woman and the pig off the plane.
You sure it wasn't her husband? I mean,
yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. I was just wondering.
Yeah, that was maybe another flight, but
or there was some aching for her bacon.
Oh boy! This is going downhill quick. There was an interesting article on the Runway Girl Network. This was by John Walton, a contributing editor there, kind of commenting on the reaction that some people have had with regard to service animals on flights. And there's been a lot of sort of negative reaction to these kinds of articles from people that say animals should not be allowed on flights under any circumstances and this sort of thing, which I think this goes way too far.
Well, you know what I have found interesting is the number of dogs. I mean, in the old days, I was used to seeing service dogs were perhaps German Shepherds, perhaps they were Golden Retrievers, but a pretty limited species spread there. But now I have seen more dogs of more odd shapes and sizes with little service dog sweaters on them. I saw a Jack Russell the other day with a service dog.
No kidding.
Maybe it is. I wanted to ask, because this lady was walking with him and she looked fine, and I wanted to ask what kind of service the dog performs. But I don't know.
Emotional
support.
There's
a lot out there that can smell diabetes, like if you're about to have, like if you're low on sugar or have a seizure. So I'm guessing a lot of the little dogs are the not obvious issues a person may not have.
Well, but shouldn't it say service dog of not an obvious nature and in the category of way cool, you know, I don't know. It's just...
And they should be properly trained. The problem with the pig on the airline and why she was kicked off is because the pig would not stop squealing and pooping all over the place.
And that's a problem.
But that's not a well-trained emotional support pig.
Yeah, and it's interesting if you Google an airline name and a service animal, and you'll quickly find that airline's webpage that describes the requirements for service animals and emotional support animals. In the case of the pig, it was an American Airlines flight. And they, and we've talked about this in the past, I think, but they have a pretty explicit rules and requirements for these kinds of animals. Both are allowed. Service animals as well as emotional support animals. For emotional support animals on an airline flight, though, for American, for example, you have to give them at least 48 hours notice. You have to have documentation from the appropriate medical professional that describes the need for this emotional support animal, things like that. You can't just walk on a plane and say, this is my emotional support ferret. I have a right to bring this on board. There's more to it.
But then,
than
how
that.
Did the pig get on the airplane? How did it get as far as coming down the jetway and getting on the airplane and the airplane taking? I mean, I don't get that.
What did the guys at TSA have to say over that? That would have been interesting.
Yeah, maybe they made the pig ride through the metal detector. I don't know.
I can just see the flight attendant coming in with the count, which is what they do just before you close the doors. And they go, we've got, 13 in first class and 107 in coach or whatever. Yeah. And a pig, and a pig. Right.
Right.
Okay, sure.
All right. Well, we've been talking about animals, but, some of the aviation organizations that provide charitable services also do that for people. As we know, we have Angel Flight. We have a press release from the National Air Transportation Association that they had a campaign going on with flag pins for veterans. And they collected a significant amount of money to support the Veterans Airlift Command, which is, that I said, that sounds familiar. And then I recalled that Carl Valeri on Stuck Mike Avcast actually talked about that organization. Well, he talked with someone from the Veterans Airlift Command, the VAC, and he also talked with a veteran and passenger. And what they do is that this is for, obviously, for veterans who have returned home, and maybe they've been through some hospitalization or some medical assistance from the government, and then maybe go home. But they may have to return later for follow-up visits and things like that. And sometimes that represents an economic hardship for the veteran. And in other cases, and I hadn't thought of this, but it makes sense. Some of them are disfigured or are missing limbs to an extent where it's very difficult to travel in public because at the airport, on the airplane, and so forth, everybody stares at them. No one knows what to say, whether to speak to them or not. And it's a very odd and kind of uncomfortable situation. And maybe you can imagine it if you kind of think about that a little bit. So traveling on public transportation can be a real problem for some of these folks. So the VAC provides that kind of transportation as an alternative. And I thought this was great. It's Stuck Mike Avcast, Victoria, I think it was episode 83. Is that the latest episode?
Episode 83 just came out today, I believe.
Oh, okay. This is...
No. We had 84 today. I think 83 was 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And it was recent.
We'll put a link in the show notes. The title is Live from the NBAA Convention 2014. So Carl had some great interviews from that. Stuck Mike Avcast. You guys are always doing such a great job. Who's the brains behind this, Victoria?
Well, Len got Stuck Mike started a couple years ago. I still say I was tricked I thought I was going to be a guest. It turns out was a co-host. So that was a surprise. But, you know, now he's around traveling the world, and Carl is doing an awesome job at taking over. And, you know, the places he goes and the people he interviews and how he finds time to just fit this in and, you know, help with the editing process is amazing. So I feel like the person who's just copying their work, I kind of show up and record, but it's a fun group and he does a great job.
It is a fun group, and you all do a great job. I think it's definitely on one of my my favorites list of aviation podcasts to listen
to. Thank you.
Well, as Max will tell you, Victoria, that a good podcaster has no life.
That's right.
I don't know how Carl has a spare time between working and getting that going. And the same with Rick and Sean. You know, Sean's a TV reporter. And so I don't know how they do it.
Yeah. So I guess we can close out there. There are other charitable organizations. I'm actually going to make a... My wife and I are going to make a really sizable donation this year to the Veterans Airlift Command. I described that to her, and I offered up about how much I thought we should contribute, which is something pretty significant. And in a heartbeat, she thought that was a great idea. So, I'd like to personally thank Carl for making us all aware of that organization. But there's lots of others. You mentioned Angel Flight. There's things like the Air Care Alliance. In Canada, there's Hope Air. There's really a wide variety of these kinds of charitable organizations. And again, I'd encourage everybody listening to, consider these when you're making up your mind about where you'd like to, donate your charitable dollars this year. I think it's worth considering these aviation organizations.
Hey, Max, I wonder if we could make a challenge out to the Airplane Geeks community and just see how much we could actually raise for them, and if there's any way to report back and say, yay, we did X number of dollars or whatever. Might be fun to get some feedback somewhere along the way. So,
yeah, well, that's a good idea.
Get on your charitable boots and donate.
That's right. And, if you send us some feedback at theGeeks@airplanegeeks.com and, let us know what organization you support, maybe, if you'd like to make a comment about the size of the donations that you make, that's fine. If not, that's fine. And then if we sum these up, let's say that we won't use any names anywhere. So just kind of in confidence that we'll protect your privacy on that. And if you have any charitable organizations that you'd like to make our listeners aware of, just send those to us as well. Again, we're talking with Victoria Zyko. Victoria, Turbo the Flying Dog. How long has Turbo been flying?
Turbo has been flying since he was 6 weeks old. You know how women usually have a clock that's ticking away, their little maternal clock, and they just want a baby? Well, I had that, but with a dog. And I had finally found the perfect puppy on New Year's Eve, and he was in West Virginia. It would have been a four-hour drive. And so what did we decide to do? We took the plane. And I originally wanted to, work my new puppy up to getting used to the airplane and the noise and, the bumps. But to save time, we went and flew to get him, and he took right to it. He fell asleep. He slept the whole time. We had one of the fastest ground speeds ever recorded in that airplane, and so he got his name Turbo.
Oh, wow. So that's pretty good. A very short break-in period for Turbo when it came to flying.
Yes.
So tell us about this book that you've written now. What's it about? Who's it for? What can you tell us?
Well, everyone was so intrigued about how Turbo was flying with us everywhere, and I was constantly posting pictures on my Facebook of him and wearing his muffs and him on the wing of the plane, and they were just so surprised that this dog was going everywhere with us. He was portable. He didn't care. He'd show up places and kids would run up and see him at the airport. And eventually a lot of people actually, were encouraging me to start a Facebook page. And so we started the Turbo the Flying Dog Facebook page, and he immediately got several hundred likes. and people were commenting on his pictures. And we got to thinking, this would make an excellent children's book series. And my friend Kelly Kennedy, she's always wanted to write a children's book, as have I. We got together and we started the series. The first book is Turbo the Flying Dog. And in this book, Turbo's all alone. It starts off kind of sad. He's all alone at the pound and doesn't have a home. And one day he learns that he will finally be picked up and have a new home of his own. But he quickly learns that he has to go home in something called an airplane. And he's never heard about an airplane before, and he doesn't know what an airplane is. And all the other dogs at the pound are telling him it's a big metal machine in the sky. And he's getting all these scary images in his head. So he's really nervous when he goes to the airport and gets to fly home. But soon after he has a chance behind the wheel, he learns that, hey, you know what? I think I like this flying thing. And that will lead into book two, where Turbo actually learns to fly.
So you plan for this to be an ongoing series?
Yes, it is.
Am I correct? Was this a Kickstarter project? Is that how you funded this?
Yep, that's exactly how we funded it. Kickstarter is a social crowdfunding place where people can bid on your project. And what's special about Kickstarter is that you really have to be realistic on your goals. Because if you can put as much money down that you want to raise. If you want to raise $150,000, you can put that down. But they want you to be realistic, because if you don't raise your goal, you don't get anything.
Right, right.
And so we had to have a solid business plan and a business model when we went in there. And we also had to do good enough marketing to get the word out about Turbo and the Turbo Project. And we also had to make sure that our backers, these people supporting us, got something good in return. So everyone who donated $30 or more have a signed copy of the book coming to them shortly. So and that includes being pawed-graphed.
That's what I was going to ask you, if that was signed by you or signed by Turbo.
All of us, yes.
What kind of a dog is Turbo again?
Turbo is a mutt. Actually did a DNA test. I just tell everyone he's West Virginia mutt. But if you put this image in your head, it's not going to look like Turbo. He's part Chinese crested. That's the bald dog.
Yes.
Part collie and part Chinook, which is one of the rarest dogs in the United States. And I don't know how that turned into him, but it did.
Yeah, there's probably a great unknown story behind how that genealogy comes together.
Very romantic, I bet.
Oh, sure. But on Kickstarter, you know, it occurs to me that, well, of course, there's a number of pilots and people interested in aviation who've written books. And there's certainly a number of people in aviation who have great stories that they could tell. Can you talk a little bit about how difficult it is to fund and to develop and to plan for a book like this? Some advice for maybe others in the aviation world who might be thinking about capturing their story in a book?
You know, it's super helpful that I had a partner in crime, and we're both very avid on social media and connecting to people. It's one thing to write a book, and writing a children's book was actually much harder than I expected. You think it's only 32 pages. You have a sentence or two per page. But actually getting your story out in that just small amount of time and to get people to engage in it is quite difficult. So that was one hurdle. And then hurdle number two is, yeah, how on earth, especially when I'm self-publishing, do I get the word out? And what's kind of unique about Turbo is that he's a real dog and people are actually following his real life story alongside his books. So social media has been amazing for that. He has the best fans. And I also, you know, I talk to other writers. I talked to Carlene Pettit. She wrote a book, Flight to Success.
Of course.
Yeah. So, you know, I asked her for some assistance and how it was for her. And so, especially if you're in the aviation community and you're writing something about aviation, I took advantage of those people and I seeked out their advice, and everyone was super helpful and willing to see you succeed. So if you don't know where to start, it's always helpful if you ask. And there's a lot of resources out there, and there's a lot of venues. And self-publishing has taken off like a rocket. And, you know, making it successful is a little bit harder, but it's definitely been a fun experience.
Oh, I'm sure.
But part of that success is usually a book tour. So you plan on taking Turbo out on book tour and do PAW signings?
Yep, exactly. We're going to have a few events locally. We're trying to make it out to Aviation Universe in Chicago sometime because they want to have the book and they're a sponsor of Stuck Mike. So, you know, we'll go wherever we can. You know, we're still on a limited budget. We're trying to, you know, use that Kickstarter money wisely. We're not just going to go off to Hawaii to sign some books. So, you know, we're doing what we can with what we have. And, you know, luckily with internet, the world has shrunk. And with GA airports, that makes it easy as well.
How about the artwork? How did you take care of that aspect? Because that's got to be big, I would think, especially in a children's book. But in any kind of book, you need more than just words.
Oh, yes. I had an image in my head for so long, and my co-author Kelly had an image in her head as well. And one of the reasons we didn't actually submit this to agents and big publishers is we were very afraid of them assigning an artist that just didn't fit the integrity and the vision we had for the series. So that is the main reason we went the self-publishing route. And you know, we were very low budget, so before we paid anyone to see samples or to search for an artist for us, we actually put a call out on Turbo's Facebook and Instagrams and said, hey, if you're a fan of Turbo, if you're an artist and have this sort of talent, please send us your bid for a 32 colored page book and send us a sample of your Turbo, what you see Turbo looking like in the series. And the response and the immediate response was overwhelming. It was just, they clicked. And we ended up picking, of all people, my husband's cousin. She submitted her work and she gave us a price. And it was like she just took Turbo out of my brain, something that I've never been able to describe in words. And she put it on the paper. So she's hired for all our books.
You know, I really love those that GoPro you put on his back. If you're a dog person, you'd think that was pretty cool. But I mean, it's he is a very fast dog.
Oh, he is fast. he turbocharges.
We're talking about, of course, you've got to go to Turbo the Flying Dog on Facebook.
Yes, exactly. You can watch the videos. He has his very own GoPro harness, and he recently filmed a Thanksgiving dinner.
So, Rob, do you think Simba the Wonder Dog has any kind of a future in publishing?
Well, possibly, but of course he's a little older than Turbo, and, you know, he does need his beauty sleep. And
you know,
he can have a cameo.
Well, that's true. We could think about that, but that GoPro on the back. I was actually thinking I could do something like that with my daughter while she's still at school.
Well, put
if
a
I
GoPro
had a child,
on your daughter?
I would so put a GoPro on them.
Yeah.
I want to put one on my chickens. So.
Well, you just mean to do it without her noticing, though, I guess.
Yeah. Now, there's this this website, Skyfunder, skyfunder.com. Is that something that's sort of focused on aviation crowdfunding?
Yeah, I stumbled across that the other day when I was looking at other like aviation related Kickstarters and or Indiegogo or what have you. And that's brand new just for people who want to fund an airplane to flight training. And
oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at their this is skyfunder.com. Flexible worldwide crowdfunding for aerospace and aviation projects. I'll have to take a look at that. Who's doing the printing? How does the actual publishing work for you, for Turbo?
Yeah, we're doing it through CreateSpace, which is a very easy website where you can upload things to. They also offer professional services if you need editing or layout services like that. And they're owned by Amazon. So it's pretty much free to use until you use some of the more advanced services, and then they can help you get on Amazon. They can help turn your book into a Kindle. They can get you in other spots as well. So a friend who Jeff Kennan wrote The Day I Learned to Fly, he published through CreateSpace. So I got to get a copy of his book and see what that looked like. And I was really impressed with the printing. And we got proof of the TurboBook the other day. And it's a great, great website, great source for people who are looking to self-publish.
And will there be a Kindle version or an iBook version?
Yes, we'll have a Kindle version out. We're probably not going to release the Kindle for the first book until maybe the second book comes out. We're going to see how the paper copies do first. It's an extra fee, but we definitely have plans to do that.
And Victoria, where can folks learn more about the book?
You can just go online at turbotheflyingdog.com. He's on Twitter at @TurboFlyingDog, and he's on Facebook /TurboTheFlyingDog.
That's great.
He's all over.
And
he's
sounds
taking
like
over social media.
It sounds like it'd make a perfect stocking stuffer for the upcoming holiday season.
Yes, it is out December 8th, so you can definitely purchase it online and on Amazon.com prior to the holiday. Mm.
Victoria, what kind of flying trips did you take this year? Anything remarkable or notable?
Shush.
Is that Turbo?
We started off this year.
To hear Max's comments, you could say it a little nicer, Victoria.
I mean, shush. I wonder.
Not you. We started off the year with flying to Bahamas. That was the first time I've flown to the Bahamas, and Turbo came with us.
Was that the first overwater flight for you?
I've flown over like the Great Lakes, but this is my first like Caribbean ocean, flight.
Is there any special gear that Turbo needs in order to do a water crossing, or just in the plane in general?
Well, you know how you're required to have life jackets aboard in case you had to ditch. So ours is just a tiny two-person plane. We had our life jackets behind us so we could grab them. We made what we call the puppy platform for Turbo. He sits in the back over our luggage on a little platform we made for him. And one of my biggest concerns were if, God forbid, we had to ditch the plane, is that I'd have to turn around to get Turbo all prepared to get out of the plane. And so the poor little thing, for the hour that we were over the ocean, he wore his life jacket while flying. So he had a doggy life jacket, and he had his mutt muffs on to protect his hearing, and he was just bundled back there in his little puppy platform ready to float.
Mutt muffs? They make mutt muffs, huh?
Yes, that's what they're called. It's actually Safe and Sound Pets, I think, is the company, and they make mutt muffs, and they look just like ordinary human headsets without the microphone, and basically gives enough cushion and just blocks the extra sound. Because, you know, being in that loud plane over time could hurt a dog's ears, and their ears are so sensitive as it is. We just didn't want to take any risks.
What kind of airplane is it, Victoria?
We have a Glass Air. It's a Glass Air 1RG. It's a two-seater experimental, cruises at about 165, 170 knots.
Yeah, nice.
Speedy.
Perfect for Turbo. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Victoria. It's been an interesting conversation. Now, why don't you give our listeners all the websites, the Twitter handles, all the places they can find you, Stuck Mike, Turbo. I know that this is a long list, but why don't you let us have it?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. I am at ToriaFly on Twitter. My blog is thepixiepilot.com. StuckMikeAvcast.com is where you can find the podcast. Same handle for Twitter. And then, like I said earlier, Turbo is at TurboTheFlyingDog.com. Facebook, the Turbo the Flying Dog. Instagram, Turbo Flying Dog. And on Instagram, he's Turbo the Flying Dog.
Wow.
And I think that's most of them. I'm kind of everywhere. Google our name. We'll be there.
Fantastic. And we'll put all of those in the show notes so folks can get to those easily.
Thank you.
All right. Anything else before we let you go?
Oh, well, you know, just thanks for having me. And I'm an open book, so to speak. So if anyone has any questions about Turbo, if anyone wants to meet Turbo and or has questions about the self-publishing you know, process I just went through, you know, feel free to contact me in any of those forms. I'm here to speak.
Does Turbo go to Oshkosh?
Oh, gosh, I would love it, but I don't think they'd be very dog friendly.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. It might be kind of difficult to manage that.
We take him wherever we can, though. I mean, he's been to the Bahamas. He's been to Canada. We've done it. So he's our baby.
Fantastic.
So there's no celebrity tent in Oshkosh?
Yeah, I'm really – that would be awesome. If I could get a picture of him and Bob Hoover, day made.
Oh, for sure.
Well, they let Steve Vischer and Grant go to AirVenture. I mean, come on.
So you're saying that if they let Australians in, they should let dogs in?
Works for me.
Okay.
I don't know. The Australians might have a better accent than Turbo.
Yeah. All right. We'll hear more about this, I'm sure. All right, Victoria, again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, guys.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks, Victoria.
And now here's Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association to tell us what to expect in the next NBAA Flight Plan podcast.
Hi, I'm Pete Combs, and if your business is flying, then you'll want to check out NBAA's Flight Plan. Whether you're flight crew, cabin crew, line crew, or maintenance, NBAA's Flight Plan is 5 minutes well spent on topics that range from safety to education to procedures both new and old. You'll find us on Apple's iTunes website or at the home of business aviation, NBAA.org.
Thanks, Pete.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Well, g'day folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 327. Well, it's Steve here. I'm flying solo again this week. Unfortunately, Grant's not able to be with us again tonight. Grant, very, very busy with his day job, or in Grant's case, day, night, and every other time of the day job. He's a very, very busy guy at the moment, finding it hard to do a bit of podcasting. In fact, we both are at the moment, but here we are at the desk. Now, I thought instead of doing some of the usual news this week, we'd do something a little bit different. In fact, we're going to talk about warbirds. Now, back in early September, the Australian National Aviation Museum celebrated a rather significant anniversary, and that is the 75th anniversary of the Commonwealth Aircraft Corporation Wirraway. The Wirraway was a very significant aircraft in Royal Australian Air Force history, primarily used as a trainer, but was also used for some combat duties back in World War II. And it was a locally produced aircraft, a variant of the, I believe, the North American NA-16. I'm sure David can enlighten us a lot more about that at the end of this segment. But we dispatched Max Flight's favourite Australian, Anthony Simmons, out to Moorabbin Airport to observe the celebrations and grab an interview or two.
I'm here at the Australian National Aviation Museum for the 75th anniversary of the CAC, Commonwealth Aircraft Corporation's Wirraway aircraft. And with me is Ewan MacArthur. He's the secretary of the Australian National Aviation Museum, and James Keightley, aviation journalist. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
If I can ask you, James, to start with, about the history of the CAC Wirraway, and then if Ewan, if you could follow up on the history of this particular aircraft.
Certainly. Well, the Wirraway is a very important aircraft in Australian history, aviation history particularly, of course. It was the first mass-produced aircraft we made in significant numbers. We'd had a couple of aircraft we'd built in sort of 5 or 10 or whatever, but this particular design was brought in. It's an American design, and we license-produced it in Australia, but we actually built both the aircraft and the engines. The company was set up in 1936. First production flights were in 1939, which is where we're on the 75th anniversary of. And the aircraft, as I say, it was very important in Australian history because we hadn't actually built cars from scratch in Australia. So we went straight from farm machinery and railway support equipment to what was the highest level of technology of the time back then. We did very well at it. The Wirraway was a good aircraft. So they built, starting with number one, and we got to number 10. 75 years ago, Ewan.
Yes, exactly. And in actual fact, just to make things a little bit more confusing, it's the this particular aircraft is the 8th production model. So I think the first two were actually the North American trainers, and then they commenced production work. So basically what we have here is the oldest surviving Wirrawai in the world, but not only that, it's actually the oldest surviving Commonwealth Aircraft Corporation aircraft now in the world. So it's actually got a dual significance in both forms. So we picked this one up from CAC many years ago, and it's undergone numerous restorations. This one, however, has been probably the most extensive one, I think, done in at least 30 to 40 years.
So this is not only a fairly groundbreaking aircraft, no, but a very historical aircraft in terms of Australian aviation history.
Absolutely. Well, especially with today, being the 6th of September, this actually is the celebration today on this day, according to its logbook, when it made its first flight.
Wow, impressive.
It's basically, it's having a very special day as a result. The finish that it's been done in is the exact finish that it would have rolled off the production line. Only the first 22 or 23, I think, were in silver. And then after that, they moved into the wartime camouflage finish. So this one also, as I understand, is now the only... I think it's the only Wirrawai now that's in silver.
Currently, I believe so, yeah.
I don't think there's any others.
And can you give me a bit of a background in regards to the actual restoration project itself? You know, an idea of how much effort's gone in.
Yeah, absolutely. This particular project is basically all volunteer hours and started about 2.5 months ago. Now, by way of comparison, the other big CAC restoration that has been done at the museum was the CAC series, which is what the Wirrawai evolved into post-war. That particular restoration took 10 years. So what you're looking at essentially is the result of people turning up every weekend, and we're talking a lot of younger people turning up, which has been fantastic under the guys. They've been under the careful eye of Ash Briggs, who is the chairman of the museum, but also a master restorer of aircraft. He's highly considered worldwide for the work that he does. So basically we stripped it down, replaced a lot of parts that were too corroded, and of course, being 75 years old, that metal wasn't made to last back then, so there was a lot of stuff there that required replacing. But yeah, the beauty of it was a lot of younger people came in, and we estimate conservatively probably about 2,500 hours over the last couple of months has been placed on this aircraft to actually bring it back to standard. We still have the original logbook. Might even see if we can dig that out a little bit later and show people. We reunited the aircraft with one of its original pilots earlier in the year, 94-year-old Murray Adams, who remarked upon seeing it for the first time that he was sure that he'd left it in better condition when he'd flown it. But yeah, they're always a dime a dozen, those pilots. But no, it was wonderful just to be able to do that, because unfortunately that's becoming too much of a rarity now.
Well, folks, so if you're interested, why not pop down and have a bit of a wander around the Australian National Aviation Museum? I can highly recommend it. It's very, very impressive. Well, Ewan, James, thanks once again from PCDU.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And thank you, Anthony. A fantastic interview there. That's, in fact, a cut-down version of about a 10-minute interview, which we'll be releasing a bit later on in the year. Well, I should say that. It's already December, isn't it? So we'd better get on with it. The Wirrawai, as you heard there, are quite a significant aircraft in Australia's aviation history. They were introduced in 1939, and they flew them for about 20 years, retiring them in 1959. There were some 755 of them produced, and they were all produced here in Australia, except, of course, for those first two development aircraft, as you heard. And for local listeners, if you haven't been out to the Aviation Museum there at Moorabbin, there's a lot of fantastic aircraft out there, and well worth a visit if you're ever out that way. Well, that's everything I have for you on this week's Australia Desk. I suppose we'll try and wheel Grant back in next week. I think that'd be good. In fact, we might make him do a bit more work next week. Until then, I'm Steve Fisher. Cheers, folks.
And thanks, Steve, and especially thanks to Anthony Simmons. Great interview. You know, Steve sent along a photo of the Wirrawai. This was taken by someone, Canvas Wings, on Twitter. We'll have to put this in the show notes, of course. But Canvas Wings, if you're interested in vintage aircraft, this is a great guy to follow. He's got some really nice photos, you know, historic photos and modern photos of historic aircraft. Lots of tweets on that topic. This is a great one. I'm going to follow this guy as soon as we're done with this show.
Hey, Max, I was just wondering, why on the airplane do they print that bullseye target? That just seems like a bad idea on an aircraft that's flying during wartime.
Yeah, I guess I've heard that before. I don't know if I've heard a really good answer to that one, though. But yeah.
It's a great photo, though.
Yeah, very much so. All right, now it's time for Peter Johnson across the pond.
Seattle Tower, Skyhawk 5440 Hotel, 10 miles southwest, looking for VFR transition west to east towards Renton.
Skyhawk 5440 Hotel, Seattle Tower, clear through Seattle Broad airspace, cross over the numbers of runway 34 center, maintain 2000 while in Bravo airspace.
Okay, 40 Hotel, clear through the Bravo, 2000, crossing 34 center, 40 Hotel.
This week, we welcome back our adopted general aviation pilot, Neil Braden. Neil, really big welcome back across this side of the pond.
Thank you. And I am literally on this side of the pond, and I'm absolutely delighted to be back on the show again.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you. When we last spoke, you were planning your return to Europe. You're back now. Just give us an update on where things are for you.
Well, sadly, I returned in May of this year, and the American dream finally had to come to an end. We knew this day would come eventually. So I've tried to think about how I could summarize the last 12 months. I certainly can't be accused of not making the most of my time in the US. And I think, I've highlighted three pretty awesome events that I went to. So I attended the Aviation Geek Fest 2014 in Seattle earlier this year, where we got to go to the two Boeing factories.
Very jealous.
Yeah, we actually got to go on the at Payne Field. We actually got to go on the floor, on the production floor, on the weekend. Underneath we were underneath a 777 from Singapore Airlines at the time.
Wow!
And then we got to go to the Renton factory, which I believe only is either 10,000 or 30,000 people get to go in there a year. But it's not really open to the public. So we saw the two 737 production lines, and that just blew me away. Another thing that I did was I had my first seaplane flight out of Lake Union in Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't really describe the feeling of being an aircraft and then suddenly becoming a boat. I think that was definitely in the top five of what I did.
Yeah.
And, my last flight in the US in May, I reached 40 airports that I landed at with a total time of 230 hours. So I don't want anyone ever on social media accusing me of not making the most of my my time in the US.
No, I don't think anyone would ever do that. And we've all watched with a great deal of interest in what you've been up to. And it's been a great, great story. But you've managed to fly again back home here in Ireland. Tell us a little bit about what the differences are. What did it feel like?
So my primary training started in Ireland back in the year 2000. So coming back was a natural progression. It felt familiar. I went flying with my original CFI. I wouldn't say it wasn't like I just left, but the airspace was familiar. Now, the challenge I have now is, apart from the $250 an hour rental for a Cessna 172.
Is that wet or dry?
That's wet, frankly. Okay. apart from that, I also have to find the $5 for each touch and go that I take. So last flight, I did six touch and goes and a full stop. So you can see how much that soon adds up. Although it being a familiar environment, the challenges for aviation over here is finding the funds. Now, on a positive note, right now I am able to use my FAA license to rent aircrafts here in Ireland.
Okay.
I just need to get checked in with the Irish Aviation Authority to close out all the paperwork. So providing that ESA doesn't change this in the future, I will certainly be looking forward to flying more in 2015.
Right, okay. Now, Neil, we've been along this journey with you. I think we first spoke back in September 2011. As we complete this phase of your flying journey, what advice and wisdom can you give us from all of this experience?
So I'm going to split this answer into two. I think I'm going to go for the left side of the pond and the right side of the pond. So those people out over in the US, my advice is to them is to continue to immerse themselves in aviation as often as they can, because general aviation is so special in America. And I challenge all those pilots out there to try and introduce someone new to GA this month. I'm proud to say that of all the times I flew over there, I only had an empty right seat once. Nothing gave me more pleasure than introducing new people to flying.
Yeah.
Time I went flying. And I also challenge those newer pilots out there in the US to start planning some bigger adventures. You know, only in the US could you land at an international airport and then the following day be sharing the pattern with an F-16 or an A-10.
Yeah, you were very lucky, very, very lucky.
And for the people over on this side of the pond, I guess it takes myself back to where I was 12 years ago when my journey started. Don't want people to give up chasing their aviation dream, because one day they might just get the breakthrough that I got, and they should really, really never give up hope.
Right. Well, that's certainly great advice. I will be taking a little snippet of that myself. Neil, it's been a fantastic journey. We will stay in touch and keep an eye on what you're up to. I know you've recently had contact with Mark Maiden as well, so we want to see your adventures there as well.
Yeah, Ireland will never be the same after myself and Mark get together a little bit more often. But before I finish up, I do want to say a couple of thank yous, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go ahead. Fire away.
Yeah, I would like to say thanks to Jill Tolman from AOPA for the coverage she's provided while I was in the US. And then a big thanks to yourself, Max, Rob and David for the coverage you provided on the Airplane Geeks since September 2011.
Wow, thanks very much. Really appreciate it. We've enjoyed watching your journey. Almost felt like we were sitting in that right seat with you. It's been fantastic. We're very proud of the success you've had, and we'll continue to watch your progress with excitement. Neil, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Peter. Goodbye.
We're basic on the come.
54288, Sedona, altimeter 3001.
3001, and actually, sir, I'm happy to cancel VFR flight following and go en route.
Number 288, roger, Scorpio, fire frequency change approved, we'll see you later.
Frequency change approved, Skyhawk 288, see ya.
Well, thanks, Peter, for that. Great to get an update from Neil. You can follow his blog at getmyppt.blogspot.com. And on Twitter, you can find Neil at pilot_NGB.
Yeah, it's really great to see someone go through the program and successfully complete it and be able to follow them along the way.
Absolutely. Yeah, it does add a lot of interest to that. Peter sent along, or maybe Neil sent along, a photo of him, of himself and the plane, and we'll have that in the show notes. Neil also mentioned the Aviation Geek Fest that he attended, and that's definitely worth mentioning if you are unaware of these. David Parker Brown does this each year. I think this is about the sixth year, maybe, that he's done this in Seattle, in the Seattle area. The 2015 event is February 21st and 22nd, and this has become gigantically popular. David Parker Brown ends up getting access to facilities that you can't easily get access to on your own, some of the Boeing plants and things like that. And I guess the group is limited in size for obvious reasons. So if you're interested in that, you can find out more at airlinereporter.com. You can find the page, or just Google Aviation Geek Fest, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. That's Rob, that's something that we need to do one of these years.
Yeah, I tried to get tickets for it, you know, by going directly to him, and he said, stand in line with everyone else.
Oh, no. Oh, I was going to say, we're going to do that right after you show up at Oshkosh.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, this is, you know, we did request last year, because these things had been held on Valentine's Day weekend, and for 2015, Aviation Geek Fest is not on Valentine's weekend. So, I mean, I think David Parker Brown maybe, you know, listened to us on that. He tried to accommodate, I guess, Rob. Maybe we're going to let him down this year. But
oh, sure. And my wife said, you're going to go to Seattle and leave me home.
Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, by moving it, that just makes it even harder to get tickets. So,
oh, dear.
Yeah, I'm more upset than most, I guess, over that, because I would go.
All right. Well, if you're interested, take a look at the website at airlinereporter.com. He's got links to the event from the last few years. You can find pictures and description of what they've done, what they've accomplished. And got to give David a lot of credit for pulling this off year after year. I got to imagine this is a big, big effort to coordinate and manage. And good job to David Parker Brown. Moving on to some listener mail, we heard from Juan. Juan sent us a photo. He was in Calgary, and he spotted a Royal Canadian Air Force plane, and he said he thought it was an MRTT that based on the A330, and he sent along a photo, which we'll put in the show notes, asked if we could shed some light on this airplane. David came back and said that that's the Voyager KC-2. Of the RAF, and David provided a video on YouTube that we'll put in the show notes, so you can take a look at that. Also, sort of in our continuing drone coverage, Tom sent us a press report. This was on the NTSB ruling in the Perker versus FAA appeal, and you know, this is the recent news story that came out, I guess, kind of just before the past week's conversations about what the FAA NPRM may look like. But just briefly, for those that haven't been following this, this goes back to a flight by Rafael Perker with his quadcopter and camera back in 2011, where he was photographing, videotaping over the University of Virginia for them. And several years later, the FAA declared that to be, well, both a commercial use of a UAV and therefore not allowable, but also that he was flying in an unsafe manner. Perker was fined $10,000 by the FAA, which he appealed. Now, when you appeal a fine from the FAA, that goes to the NTSB. And the first step in that process is an administrative law judge who reviewed the case and ended up siding with Perker, really based on two main points. One was that the FAA does not have any regulations in place officially that govern UAVs. They have policy statements and some declarations like that, but none of them pass the test of falling into the regulatory category. The other thing is that the NTSB administrative law judge declared that Perker's UAV was in fact a model aircraft, and the FAA has a long history of not regulating model aircraft, instead leaving that to model aircrafters, and so he rejected it on that. Well, the FAA appealed, and when that happens, the appeal is made to the to the NTSB board itself. And what just happened recently is the board came back with its determination that the quadcopter does fall under the definition of an aircraft as defined by existing code, U.S. code and regulations. And so he remanded the case back to the NTSB administrative law judge, which is where it stands now. So it's a case that, well, this could go on for quite some time. I know a number of people when the NTSB administrative law judge first ruled earlier this year that or sided with Perker, everyone thought this was an indication that it's okay to go out and fly commercial missions with UAVs, which is, you know, not really the case. I think some people jumped the gun on that assumption. So thanks to Tom for kind of passing that along. And again, not to make this another UAV Digest episode, but for those that are interested in that topic, you can follow along on the show that David and I do each week.
Did you ever get to see that video that was the source of all the controversy?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I saw it. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, it really raises a number of issues. There are, without doubt, and I think actually Perker might fall into this category, there are some quadcopter or UAV pilots who are very skilled, who know what they're doing. They've been doing it for a long time. They really fly professionally in terms of their capabilities to operate these kind of craft. Having said that, in this video, you see Perker flying this thing close to some automobiles. There's a sort of a walkway over a road that he flies under, and then there's sort of a short tunnel that he flies through. And even if you say that, well, you know, that's not a challenge for somebody as skilled as this guy, perhaps, put yourself in the position of an automobile, and you're coming out of a tunnel, and there you see 20, 30 feet above you this object hurtling towards you. That's a way to cause an accident. So I'm not so sure that this doesn't represent an unsafe flight. I don't know. What did you think, Rob? Did you think this was an example of safe operation?
Well, it's funny because the first time I saw it, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I was just mesmerized because I wasn't even certain at first what I was seeing.
Yeah.
Because I just had never seen any videos like that. At first I said, well, gee, this must be, what would you call it?
Some really good computer.
Yeah, computer enhanced or something. And then I realized what it was. And sure. But of course, to be fair, that's not what the NTSB ruled on. They didn't rule on whether his flight was actually reckless or not. They're going to leave that for the FAA. And all they did was say that, yep, the FAA can tell you what to do in this case. So, but I do think your point is well taken that when they ruled for this fellow initially, that many other people said, oh, it's not that big a deal. Come on, how are they going to catch you? And it kind of got out of hand.
It did. There are many people out there who are flying commercially, and many of them are not shy about it at all. I mean, I've seen stories reported in magazines, national magazines, describing, for example, a session filming commercials for an auto manufacturer. I think some people think that they can do it and it's not a problem. Other people know that it's kind of an issue with the FAA, but to do it anyway. There's a whole spectrum of folks. But the people that I worry about the most, and I think this is, when we see about all these stories about the quadcopters getting close to commercial aircraft at JFK and other airports, is that I think in many cases, these are from people that don't come from a background in aviation. Right? They don't understand aviation safety. And I've said this in the past, but the people who grew up with radio-controlled aircraft really grew up in a culture of safe operation. People that go into Amazon and say, for $800 or $1,200, I can buy this DJI Phantom with a GoPro camera and create amazing videos. What a blast. I'm going to go out there and fly around. Those are the people that in many cases don't appreciate the safety aspects of flying in the airspace. And those are the dangerous people, I think.
Well, yeah. And right now there is no regulation at all other than this ruling the other day that said the FAA has the authority to look at these things as if they are model airplanes. And hence why I was getting a little crazy with this lady on CNBC last week to say that it's the same thing as an Airbus, which is even scarier. I don't know. She just completely went out of left field there. And I think that's the problem, is that people don't feel like the drone industry has a focus on safety. They have a focus on getting them built and getting them flown, which is okay, but there's a third leg to the stool.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And the technology is amazing. Some people have asked me, where did drones come from? Why do we have all these things all of a sudden? What made all this possible? And you know what it really is, I think, is smartphones. Because the technologies developed for smartphones, small, lightweight, low-power GPS, motion sensors, all of those kinds of things, those are integrated into these small UAVs and make this possible. I mean, you can do first-person view where you fly this thing out of your sight, but the camera is transmitting back to you. You're looking at a little screen, you know, just like the guys in Arizona directing the military drones. The capabilities are amazing, and for people who like to fly stuff, you know, the attraction is very great. But it's like you say, Rob, there are lapses or we are lacking in awareness, I think, in terms of what the responsibilities are, what the issues are. And we have people flying in a dangerous manner. Not that they're trying to be dangerous, or not that they're, you know, they're just not aware of what the issues are in a lot of cases.
And sure, and I think it is similar to the way that laser pointers started out. It was just kind of cool, and you could do fun things with it. And then you had people kind of go off on a tangent because it wasn't regulated, and anybody could buy them, and the power was whatever it was. And people started doing some really stupid things with them. And the fact that we have any reports of these things flying around an airport tells me that there are probably way more of them than we know about. Mm. And these just happen to be the ones that people have seen. And unfortunately, I'm sorry, that's dangerous.
It
really is.
It's so dangerous.
Well, it's not only dangerous around airports. The other day I was over at the Rose Bowl, and I was riding my bike around the Rose Bowl, and there's a park, and they have three soccer fields set up. So people were playing soccer, and across the way a little bit, people were using their UAVs, and some had radio-controlled aircraft as well. But this one quadcopter, for whatever reason, ran out of battery, the pilot was distracted, whatever, it ended up crashing in the middle of the soccer game. Now, fortunately, it didn't hit anyone, but I see that as being equally as dangerous as flying it into an airplane.
Yeah, for sure, because you know some of these things have some really powerful motors spinning at really high RPMs. Some of the more, I'll say, toy-like quadcopters, you know, they don't really represent that much of a danger. But there are others, these big, powerful ones, carbon fiber blades. Those things could do a lot of damage to not only personal property, but to human beings. This could be a very ugly situation. And, you know, it feels like it's almost inevitable that it's going to happen, and it's going to be really unfortunate. But
I don't think there's any doubt. I don't think you can see this many drones coming online without somebody, you know, without one of these things getting loose. It's going to happen. And then everyone's going to say, how did this happen? Oh, my gosh. Why doesn't the FAA do something about that? And,
Just maybe we can kind of close this conversation, but Well, I'm not envious of the task that the FAA has. I mean, I've criticized the FAA. A lot of people have criticized the FAA for taking too long and, you know, holding up the development of, you know, opportunities for these things. But honestly, I'd really hate to be in their shoes. They've got a really, really difficult task to pull this off. One way to look at this, and this, I'm not the originator of this concept, but go back to the Wright brothers and think about, okay, maybe a few months after the first flight, there's some flights under their belts, aviation is just getting started. What if at that time you said, I mean, the FAA didn't exist, but what if that time you said, okay, go off and develop the regulations for aviation? Where would you start? You don't know where to start because you don't have any history or any significant history of flight. We're kind of in the same situation with UAVs right now. I mean, yeah, they fly, they're out there, we know a little bit about them, but when it comes to their operation in the national airspace with other aircraft, we don't have a lot of experience. It's difficult to create regulations for something that doesn't really exist yet. You know what I mean, Rob?
Sure. Well, in fact, it's funny, after that aviation minute a couple of weeks ago, somebody sent me a paper. I can't remember the name of the group. It was some defense group that was looking into the technology itself. You might already know about it, but it said that the sense and avoid technology for whatever category of drone we decide this is necessary for is still a long way away from being practical. So I don't know what they're going to do with this at that point.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, the FAA is starting with small UAVs, right? That's what they're looking at now. There's the whole other part of the spectrum of UAVs. There's the big, you know, the big long endurance, high altitude UAVs. That's kind of also easy because they're maybe mostly above commercial airspace. But it's the whole group of craft in the middle that you got to have sense and avoid. They're coexisting in the same airspace, and so you have to develop the technologies that keep that airspace safe. And we're a ways away from that, probably years away from that. And you can't force it, or you shouldn't force it, before the technology is ready and before the understanding of the dynamics of having all these aircraft of various sorts, manned and unmanned, in the same airspace. It's going to take time. I don't think there's any way around it. Well, okay, so with that, I think we should close this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I want to thank you all for listening. This has been episode 327. So you can find us at airplanegeeks.com, or the show notes are available directly at airplanegeeks.com/327. We want to thank our guest, Victoria Zyko. You can find her, well, all over turbotheflyingdog.com, stuckmikeavcast.com, thepixiepilot.com, Turbo the Flying Dog on Twitter, also on Twitter, stuckmikeavcast, and all the other places that she mentioned, and we'll try to collect them all in the show notes. You can also find out more about us in our contributors at airplanegeeks.net. That has links to the websites, recent episodes. You can actually listen to some episodes right from that site, tweets, contact information, lots more. And that's for the Airplane Geeks podcast, this one. Also, Rob's Jetwine blog, the UAV Digest podcast that David and I do. Also, his What Just Flew By blog. And also from our contributors, the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast and the Aviation Extended podcast. All that at airplanegeeks.net. All right. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Rob, any closing thoughts?
Closing.
Put you on the
spot.
No,
actually, I have nothing. I have nothing to close with other than say thank you for listening and come back next week.
All right. How about you, Brian? Anything you'd like to finish off with?
Oh, I might get some fans with this one or lose some. I'm not quite sure which, but I hope next week we don't talk so much about drones.
I know I think we're gonna hear a little bit about that. So, we'll cut that back for sure.
It's my fault.
And I'm just I hope everyone in the States had a real happy Turkey Day and didn't eat too much and suffer the ill effects of tryptophan and all that stuff. So. It is holiday season, so I hope everyone had a good one.
It feels
well.
Like
I'm
it.
Just glad that nobody droned on about turkey. I mean, because that's really annoying.
Okay, all right, everybody, join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
This was, Brian, this was priceless. I even told Lisa about this. So there's this was on CNBC, right?
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
So there's Rob and this other woman, but they were asking Rob a question and the woman a question, back and forth, and that was all, it was all very nice. And then they asked this woman a question, and she starts to give this answer, and I'm like, what? And then somebody in the control room was smart enough to they switched to you, Rob, and they caught the tail end of the classic Rob Mark eye rolling. it was beautiful.
It's even better than the regular eye rolling because I think I shook my head at the same time, and You know, it's funny, when I showed it to my daughter when she was home at Thanksgiving, she said, "Oh my God, Dad, you're on TV."
Well, so they couldn't resist. I think they were done with the segment, but they said, we were really out of time, but Rob, you look like, something like this. Rob, you look like you disagree. They had to go to you, Rob, because with a look like that.
It was hilarious. It really was.
It was.
Oh, God.
Priceless. Well, hi, Victoria.
Hi there. How you doing?
We're great. How are you? Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
I went to like the orphans Thanksgiving because my husband was out of town. Oh. But it was good.
And so to top it off, you decided to hang out with a bunch of turkeys tonight.
I forgot. I was on the show back in January.
Yes,
and that's when I was having frost quakes on my deck, and it was scaring the hell out of me.
Frost quakes?
Yes, they're when water suddenly freezes in the wood on the deck, and it creates this popping sound, and it sounds like gunshots. And I remember listening to this while trying to be calm and record and wondering what the hell was going on.
So last time you were on this show, you thought people were shooting at you.
Yes.
Tonight, you're in your PJs, and you are burning up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good things happen when I'm hanging out with you.
Rob.
Three podcasters walk into a bar. Okay. I'm sorry, yes.
The first one gives a countdown.
All right.
That would be you, Rob.
Oh, that would be me, right. One. I'm sorry, it's Monday. What can I tell you?
Okay.